Happy St. Patrick's Day. May the luck of the Irish be with us here this week on a special St. Paddy's Day edition of the Salamaster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com, episode 210 for Saturday, March 17th, 2012. Actually, it's quite appropriate that I would use that theme music to open the show this week, considering that we've got some news to talk about with respect to leprechauns, and I've got some choice words for one Hornswoggle on this week's show. So that's just by complete coincidence that we would open with that. We're going to talk about Raw. I know a lot of you are waiting for my thoughts on the Rock concert against John Cena's rap, so we're going to get into that. We've got some stuff to cover here. Eric Bischoff opening his big mouth. As a matter of fact, it has been quite a while since I have done this, but we have got two idiots for the price of one on Twitter this week to single out for their dumb remarks. So we'll get to that, but first, I don't often talk about NXT on this show. I just usually don't watch it. I don't have time to watch it, or I just don't care. If you are a fan of tag team wrestling, this week might be the week for you to check out NXT on YouTube. William Regal is now the official matchmaker on that show, and he announced this week that it would be an all-tag team edition of NXT with nothing but tag matches. So they've had the Usos in action. They had the team of Titus O'Neil and Black John Cena. They had Curt Hawkins and Tyler Rex, who, by the way, you know, Hawkins and Rex, watching them on this show, they really do have something as an act. You know, when Curt Hawkins is trotted out on Raw every now and then as a single, I think actually the last time he probably had a singles match on Raw may have been the squash from Brodus Clay, but he doesn't really do anything for me. But you watch Hawkins and Rex as a tag team, and they have something. You know, they feel like they should be on Raw or SmackDown right now, not floundering on this show. So anyway, if you have 45 minutes to spare, check it out. It was the episode that aired this past week. I believe the main event, if I remember correctly, was Derek Bateman and Caitlin in a mixed tag against Johnny Curtis and Maxine. But if you are a fan of tag team wrestling, this is the show for you. You don't see this very often on the main shows, so you might want to take a break and watch NXT for one time at least. You can go on YouTube, and actually I think it still airs on television internationally. But if you missed it, go on the WWE Fan Nation channel. You could find the entire show on there. Let's talk about Raw from Monday night. Deconstructing Monday Night Raw. We had ourselves a very attitudinal edition of the show last Monday night. I know this because Michael Cole told me no less than six times on this show how attitudinal it was. I really enjoyed it, actually. I thought it was the best Raw show of the past couple of weeks. There have been some good ones. This was probably the best of the bunch. I thought the Cena rap and the Rock concert were very entertaining. Though, as we'll get into here, I question whether or not it's really adding any interest or buys for WrestleMania, which is kind of the point, being that these two guys are in the main event. The quarreling GM storyline with Teddy Long and John Laurinaitis is progressing nicely. But perhaps most importantly, the Funkasaurus is free again. He escaped capture. He was back on my television screen on Monday night. I cannot tell you how happy I was when they put that graphic up on the screen hyping that Brodus Clay was coming up next. That just made my entire night. So let's break this down piece by piece as we deconstruct Raw from Monday night. Show open with John Cena coming out to his old basic Thugonomics theme, dressed up as the old school doctor himself, which, if Michael Cole knew what he was talking about, was not attitudinal so much as it reminded me of the Ruthless Aggression era, which I think is an often forgotten era in WWE history, but that really was the era that character appeared in. So Cena certainly looked aggressive here in this segment. Not once did a smirk or a smile besmirch this man's face. That alone made this segment a win in my book. He rapped about the notes on Rock's wrist again. He mentioned that the fans chanted Tooth Fairy at The Rock last week, which I figured would be bad news for The Rock later in the show. And in fact, there were no Tooth Fairy chants at all, at least none that I could tell that were audible on TV. So pretty much he was right back to having the crowd The Rock was in the palm of his hand. So much for trying to get a split reaction from the fans heading into the pay-per-view. Cena threatened to give Rock something called a Cleveland Steamer, which I admit I did not know what that was. I had to look it up. And I wasn't the only one, since Cleveland Steamer was soon trending worldwide on Twitter. What a lovely thing for kids to see when they type that into Google. I was thoroughly appalled. Cena made fun of The Rock for having surgery on his nipples years ago, which was kind of interesting that he would bring that up. That was the time period when Rock went through wrestling in the black tracksuit for a couple of months while he recovered. I think he was wearing the black tracksuit actually during that I Quit match with Mankind at the Rumble. So it was that late 98, early 99 period when he had the surgery, and it took him a little while to recover. Cena called Rock a Miami fried chicken shit, which got bleeped. He ended the rap by pulling out a package of nuts, which he used to toss those out into the crowd. That was kind of his gimmick back in the day. So he pulled out a pack of nuts and then threatened to teabag The Rock at WrestleMania. That almost makes me want to sell my ticket to somebody else. Actually, it makes me think that there really is something to Rock constantly using gay jokes. You know, when Rock talks about Cena, he has a tendency to fall back on the homophobic stuff and, you know, John Cena, you know, got shot out of Barney's anus and, you know, this and that, and make gay jokes at the guy's expense. But, you know, watching this and listening to Cena's words, I was really starting to think that there's something to Rock using those jokes. It's a hard thing to dispute when he's out there talking about giving The Rock a Cleveland steamer and teabagging the guy. I'm just saying. Cena threw the mic down, he walked off. I will say that if I was a parent and had taken my kid to this show, I would have not been a happy camper at all. But I don't have kids, so I fucking loved it. I'll talk more about this when we get to the end. I'll do a comparison of this and The Rock segment. But for now, just know that I really enjoyed the throwback John Cena on Monday night for a variety of reasons. So I thought this was great. We had a nice cameo appearance also during this segment. I don't know how many of you noticed, but La Parca was in the crowd, or at least someone dressed up as La Parca. But I like to think that the real La Parca is so excited for this John Cena Rock match at WrestleMania that he flew himself all the way to Cleveland just to see the show up close. That's what I choose to believe. Sheamus beat Dolph Ziggler in a really good match. Aside from that botched Emerald Frozen there at the end that Sheamus had attempted, he kind of gave up on it. They worked well together. They gave it some time. This was really good stuff. Dolph is great, but as I said on Twitter, between the pink tights, the posing, him using the Famouser as a finishing move, which never works, he is a carbon copy of Billy Gunn, and I don't mean that in a good way. You know, Billy Gunn was a very good athlete. That's why WWE back in the day wanted to push Billy Gunn. They made him King of the Ring, and he had that match at SummerSlam with The Rock, and then they kind of gave up on him at that point. Because at the end of the day, Billy Gunn really wasn't that great of a wrestler. But he was a great athlete, and Dolph Ziggler, the difference is Dolph Ziggler is a great athlete who actually can work. But he comes out, and with the hair and the pink tights and the way he poses and flexes his muscles, I mean, if I didn't know any better, I would literally think it was Billy Gunn from back in the day. So I think he needs to tweak that in some way. I also like the quick cut during this match to Josh Matthews up in the luxury box with Daniel Bryan and AJ. I would have done a split screen with live action on the left and this on the right, which I don't think they did that. But it added nicely to things. I think the first time I saw them do this was a couple of months back. They had Josh Matthews up in the skybox with Wade Barrett. And they, I think during his feud with Randy Orton, and they did that. So I like it. It's a nice touch. The bad part that I have to mention here is that as great as Daniel Bryan's heel run has been, this feels like one of the most anticlimactic World Heavyweight Championship main events in WrestleMania history. I don't know what it is, but you know, they need to heat things up very quickly between these two guys. You know, this match was always going to be the fourth main event on Mania at best, but it should at least feel like a Mania main event, and to me it really doesn't. And I don't think that it's either guy's fault. I just think it's kind of the situation that they put them in. This match really just doesn't feel big at all. And Daniel Bryan's the world champion. He's been the world champion for a couple of months now. Sheamus is your Royal Rumble winner. This match needs to feel bigger than it does. And they got to work on that. The team of Mark Henry and David Otunga beat Santino Marella in a handicap match. This was supposed to be a mixed tag that was going to be Santino and Oksana in action. But John Laurinaitis came out, announced that it would be a handicap match. Teddy Long came out, got up in Laurinaitis' face, shoved him down. The good thing about this is that the crowd was really into it, and there was so much commotion going on at ringside. Again, it felt chaotic as things went on. Santino was going wild in the ring for a little bit. Unfortunately, he got cut off by Mark Henry, World's Strongest Slam, 1-2-3. Mark Henry finally wins a match. I was amazed by this. So after the match is over is where things kind of break down into chaos. Kofi Kingston runs down to try to make the save because they're about to do some bad things to Santino. So he comes down gets taken out for his trouble. R-Truth comes down. He gets taken out as well by a Mark Henry splash. And John Laurinaitis announces that Mark Henry would officially be on his WrestleMania team in that 12-man tag team match, of which David Otunga, by the way, is considered the team captain. So think about that for a second. On a team that's going to include a couple of former world champions, David Otunga is considered the team captain. Let that sink in for a moment. So anyway, this I actually enjoyed the hell out of this. You know, Kofi coming down, getting beaten down. R-Truth comes down, he gets beat down. There was something about this that really felt, like I said, chaotic is the word that comes to mind, but there was something about this that I really liked. Maybe it was just the fact that Mark Henry, for the first time in seemingly months, was portrayed as something of a monster, which he absolutely has not been of late. Maybe he's finally healthy enough to, you know, to be that guy again. I don't know. But I really enjoyed this, and I like the way they're building this match up. It's so different than just sticking everybody in a battle royal. You know what I mean? Like, this 12-man tag was announced, and this is actually the first I'm mentioning of it, and I'm going to talk about WrestleMania in a little bit and about the new matches that have been added to the card. But again, what I love about this is that this match has purpose. It has a meaning. It's not just sticking a bunch of guys who unfortunately have nothing else to do at WrestleMania, which, you know, this match kind of is. This is a collection of guys who don't have anything else to do at WrestleMania, but they're giving them a purpose. It's not a meaningless match. These guys are fighting for the right to have either Teddy Long or John Laurinaitis, whoever they're aligned with, whoever they prefer to be in charge. They're fighting for the right for their man to be in charge of both Raw and SmackDown. It's different, so I like that. They also had a backstage segment here. This was something else. Zack Ryder complained that Eve Torres was not getting back to him via text, was not returning his calls. He wanted to know if Eve was playing games with him, playing with his head. Eve said that they could be friends, which Zack was not very happy with. And then she said, well, we can be friends with benefits, which always works out well. So they agreed to go out for dinner when Raw was over. And then Beth Phoenix came in and they started complaining about how she was, you know, wasn't on extra. And they brought up Maria Menounos. And again, we'll get to all that in a second when we talk about new matches for Mania. But this segment was something else here, you know, because I've said before, I don't know exactly where they're going with the Zack Ryder stuff. He looked like a complete nerd on the show. Was it last week? I think it was when he basically blew off Eve and then she confronted him backstage and they ended up smooching. And he played it as though, oh my God, I can't believe the prettiest girl in school kissed me. And it's like he fell in love with her all over again. And I thought, you know what? If this is leading to something at WrestleMania where Zack will embarrass Eve in front of the world, it's all just a ruse. He still doesn't like her. He hasn't forgiven her, but he's going to lead her on and make fun of her. I'm actually okay with that. But now I question whether or not that's even the plan. Because here's Zack, clearly playing it up as though he's still into Eve. He still can't let it go. He still thinks that she really has feelings for him, when obviously she doesn't. And this guy just, you know, this is a guy that WWE is trying to push. He sells merchandise. He's over with the fans. I don't see him as a main eventer with this gimmick. We've talked about this before. Zack Ryder, you know, woo, 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 Long Island IZ is not a world champion. He can only go so far with this character, but that doesn't mean you got to bury the character 6 feet under. But that's exactly what they're doing here. They're going out of their way to make this guy look like a complete tool. If that's the mission, hey, mission accomplished. Because I you know, maybe in the end he will embarrass Eve. Maybe that is where this ends up going. But you watch this show and I mean, God, it doesn't seem like that's the way they're going at all. And then after the show, it made it even worse. You know, they play this up on Twitter for the storyline. You know, they're both in character on Twitter, these people are. And Zack was commenting after the show about how he was waiting for Eve to arrive or to get back to him or whatever the case was. And basically, Eve blew him off. Eve did not go out to dinner with him. She claimed that something came up, and this guy was the saddest guy you'll ever find in the world of Twitter. How could anybody in their right mind feel sorry for this guy? How could anybody in their right mind feel sorry for him without pointing at him and laughing? They had some stuff backstage with Miz confronting John Laurinaitis, wanting to be on his team at WrestleMania. It's the Miz. Who cares? Let's get to what really matters here. Brodus Clay, back on Raw this week, for the first time in a month, maybe a little more than a month. And he comes out, beats Jinder Mahal, literally in about 20, maybe 25 seconds. And it seems to me that he had to modify his act. You know, he didn't use the same splash coming off the ropes. He used a very basic splash. You know, Jinder Mahal got thrown. It was like a suplex. And Brodus came off the ropes, gave him a splash, 1-2-3, match over. It almost seemed to me like maybe they were just running low on time. Not that this match would have gone 5 minutes anyway, but I'm hoping that it was just a matter of them running low on time, because Brodus was not necessarily the same Brodus that we saw the last time we saw him on television. He was not all... It didn't look like he was having as much fun. He wasn't, you know, saying, you know, my bad, and should I get him, and all that good stuff. There was nothing new part of his act. He literally threw Jinder Mahal, splashed him, pinned him, and that was the end of it. So hopefully that was just a situation where they were crunched for time and not Brodus Clay being, you know, beaten down by WWE management into being just another guy who goes out there and doesn't really care and there's nothing really fun. Because that was the whole point of the Brodus Clay character before. It was fun. He was having fun. We were having fun. And this wasn't quite the same. But still, I was very happy to see him back out there. Now, here's the thing with Brodus Clay. I would not have done this if I were WWE. I would not have brought him back in this way. He never should have been taken off television in the first place. But that's neither here nor there. Here's an idea that I would have gone with for Brodus Clay on Monday night. The guy has been off television for a month. You're going to bring him back. What was he doing on television before you took him off? He was squashing people. Week after week after week, which I think is fine. I don't think we see enough of that when they introduce a new character. Usually that new character, they come up with some hokey storyline, or they come in and in their first match, they're up against a mid to upper mid card guy. So more often than not, there are guys who make a debut and don't even win in their first match. It's a no contest where they lose because they feel, how can we beat this other guy? This guy is new. He just came in. The problem is they don't have jobber matches like they used to on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge and even the early days of Raw, because television now is very different than the way it was 15 years ago. Fine. So I actually like them bringing Brodus in. He beats one guy. He beats another guy, a Curt Hawkins, a Tyler Rex, guys they're not doing anything with. So now all of a sudden he's gone for 4 weeks. Let's be honest. Before he got taken off TV, it was starting to get redundant. Even I was saying they've got to do something different. At some point they've got to put Brodus in a feud with somebody. It looked like maybe they were about to do something with him and William Regal. It would have been played for comedy, I'm sure. But then nothing happened. So instead of bringing him back to do the exact same thing he was doing before, which was already getting old, you've got this 12-man tag team match at WrestleMania, which means you've got 6 slots to fill on the babyface side, of which even today there's still 2 or 3 slots open. We still don't know everybody who's going to be in that match. Let's say that Brodus Clay gets one of those spots, which I think would be a fine idea. You've got 6 spots to fill. Brodus Clay is a new character. You just brought him back to TV. Obviously, you want to do something with the guy. He's got a great entrance. I think Brodus Clay doing his entrance at WrestleMania would be a cool little moment. Why not put him in that match? And in doing so, why not bring him back on this show during the Mark Henry segment earlier on? You know, you had Mark Henry and David Otunga about to kill poor Santino Marella, who the fans love. So Kofi Kingston runs down to the ring to try to save him. He gets beat down. R-Truth comes down to the ring. He gets beat down. Both guys have been taken out. Santino's about to get the hell beaten out of him when all of a sudden, after a month off, nobody's expecting it, Brodus Clay's music hits. And out comes Big Brodus, but Brodus doesn't come out dancing with the girls. Brodus comes out in his usual gear, but he's serious. He looks like he's in a foul mood. And he comes down to the ring to confront Mark Henry, because Mark Henry, after all, he's the strongest man in the world, right? Big guy. Took out Kofi, took out Truth. Well, here's a guy who almost is the same size as Mark Henry. Here's another big guy. You want to beat up on all these little guys, why don't you take on somebody your own size? Brodus gets in the ring and you have a face-off. You have a face-off in the middle of the ring. Brodus Clay backs down Mark Henry. Mark Henry is teasing that he and Brodus are going to go at it. Has second thoughts, after all. That's what happens when you're a heel. Or either that or John Laurinaitis holds him back and says, not now, not now. And they leave. And the fans boo. You can't tell me that would not have gotten a big reaction from the crowd. And it adds an edge to the Brodus Clay character. He can go out there and dance and have a good time and be a fun comedy character. But he has to be a character like that who has a mean streak. This was the perfect opportunity to do something like that with Brodus. And they fucked it up. In my opinion, they really botched it up here. Brodus may still be added to that match, but that right there was a great, great, great opportunity to bring him back and to add something to his character to make him more serious. And that face-off with Mark Henry in that situation would have been perfect, and I'm pissed off they didn't do that, but that would have been a great idea. Shawn Michaels came down to the ring to cut his promo on The Undertaker. The biggest surprise of the night to me was Shawn Michaels appearing on television without a hat. We always see Shawn Michaels with a hat. You know, he's always worn a cowboy hat. I will say, Michaels, even back in 97, would come out sometimes wearing a cowboy hat. He's a Texas guy. But I think Michaels wears hats more often now because obviously his hair is thinning. So I was actually really surprised to see him without a hat on TV. But anyway, he comes out, and this is the big confrontation they hyped up with him and The Undertaker. And Michaels says that, you know, last week, Triple H made a comment that people were calling him a loser behind his back. And he said that nobody's been saying that to him backstage, but Undertaker hasn't been around, so therefore, it must be The Undertaker who's going around calling him a loser. Interesting logic. So Undertaker comes out, and I will say this about The Undertaker. Undertaker, when he was on Raw last time cutting a promo, I think we remember what happened. He didn't have the best night. He got whatted by the fans in Minneapolis. I was extremely upset by this, as a lot of you were. It was just very disrespectful on their part to do that. And it just shouldn't have happened. Even if Undertaker was having a bad night on the stick, you don't want The Undertaker. And the fans here in Cleveland started to want The Undertaker, and Shawn Michaels was smart enough to quickly cut them off, so it really didn't become as much of an issue on this show. But again, shame on those people. But here's Undertaker again for his second big promo. And boy, did he not have a good night. Undertaker, for the second time in a row, in my opinion, having a really off night on the microphone. He just looks lost out there. You know, I know he's playing the old Undertaker character. He's not the badass. He can't talk like that. So he's got to talk slow. And again, he talks about stealing souls and shit like that. I get that. But he just looks lost. Like he's trying to find the words he wants to say, and either he's forgetting or I don't know what it is. Again, I don't blame the crowd in this case. I just think he was really bad. He was really awful out there. Michaels was great. I thought Shawn Michaels did a fine job here. If anything, Michaels saved the whole segment, because this was a good segment overall. And at the very end, they saved it. But this was not a good night for The Undertaker. Just a really horrible job. And, you know, he was talking about the money line here came at the end when Shawn Michaels said how ironic it could be that even after Undertaker dispensed with Michaels, basically retired him, beat him 2 years in a row at WrestleMania, Michaels could not get the job done. He could not end the streak. And how ironic it is that they now find themselves in a situation with Michaels as the referee where, in theory, Michaels could turn out to be the guy who helps end the Undertaker streak after all. I thought that was a really, really cool line to put in there. It's a really good sense of logic to inject into this match because it's absolutely true. Michaels could very well favor his best friend and assist in ending the streak at WrestleMania. I really liked that. I thought that was really cool. And Undertaker got up in Michaels' face at one point and basically said, listen, he says, if you don't do the right thing, you know, if you don't do the right thing, or I think he talked about, you know, ending the streak, I'm going to end you, which I also thought was a pretty good line. And that was when Michaels patted him on the shoulder and walked away. And Triple H did come out. He didn't say anything. He came out on stage. Him and Michaels kind of locked eyes. Michaels continued on to the back. Triple H gazed at The Undertaker in the ring, gave him a crotch chop, and walked off. I thought this segment was really good. It ended strongly. But The Undertaker's actual promos of late have not been good. They have not been good. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's rust. He hasn't cut promos in quite a long time. I don't know if he just doesn't have it anymore when it comes to promos. But this was not good. But it was saved by Shawn Michaels. And again, I did like the line there at the end. So I thought that was good. And of course, the other thing about this promo was, the other thing that Undertaker fucked up was the date of WrestleMania. He said to Shawn Michaels, you know, he mentioned the date April 21st, and the only thing I could think of was, is my ticket wrong? I'm fucked if that's the case, because my airfare is already booked for the end of the month. I hope that, you know what, wouldn't it be funny after all these years, all the victories, and talking about the streak, and is The Undertaker going to go 20-0, wouldn't it be a creative way for WWE to book this if The Undertaker actually thinks that WrestleMania is 3 weeks later than it is, and he shows up in Miami on April 21st to an empty arena, to an empty stadium, with his luggage in hand going, where is everybody? And he misses WrestleMania, and Triple H wins by forfeit and breaks the streak by forfeit. What a hell of a way to end the streak that would be. It would be creative, if nothing else. I will say that. Anyway, CM Punk and Miz had a match, and the only thing I could think of when they announced this match was, why are they doing this match again? We have seen CM Punk and The Miz several times hook up on Raw. Every single time the matches were no good. The people did not care. The matches themselves had, you know, botched moves, or even if nothing was botched, just CM Punk and The Miz don't have good chemistry, in my opinion. The only good match I've ever seen the two of them in, if I remember, The Miz was in that triple threat match with Punk and I think Del Rio. At the TLC pay-per-view in December, they had a TLC match. That was actually a really good match. But it was a triple threat match, and it was a gimmick. CM Punk versus The Miz one-on-one, no good. I've never seen a good match between these two guys. They bore me. And I don't blame CM Punk for that either. So when they announced the match, I really was kind of shocked they were putting these two guys together again. The other thing also about Punk and The Miz together in matches, if you look at the Raw ratings patterns, none of their matches have ever done good. In fact, this may have been the worst of the bunch because, you know, when Michaels was out there with Undertaker and Triple H, I think something like almost 900,000 people tuned into Raw. One of the biggest pickups on the entire show, if not the biggest pickup of viewers for any one segment on the entire show. And as soon as that match was over, you had the WWE Champion come out for a match with the man who headlined WrestleMania just a year ago, and almost every single one of those 900,000 or so people tuned out. It was amazing. Talk about an exodus of viewers. So this match was it was what it was. It wasn't a horrible match, but it was a basic match. And Miz did the job, as he does always, as always in these things. He did the job to CM Punk. He tapped out to the Anaconda Vice for the submission, as he should, since Punk is the WWE Champion. And that was it. So this match didn't do anything for me. The big news was after the match was over. Chris Jericho appeared on the Titantron. He referred to CM Punk as a fraud. And basically, he cut a promo on Punk, bringing up the fact that Punk's father was an alcoholic. And this was the reason why CM Punk was straight edge. Because his father used to drink, and Punk swore it off and said that he wouldn't be like his father. And he said this is why Punk turns to tattoos and, you know, puts tattoos all over his body. And he vowed to, basically, make Punk drink. Is what he did. He said that he was going to... I think he said he was going to pour it down his throat himself. This reminded me of the Jerry Lawler, Jake Roberts feud from 1996, if you remember that. They had a match at SummerSlam that year, which I believe was actually in Cleveland, ironically enough. It's probably in that very building. Although that may have been the Gund. I don't know if the Gund Arena... I think this is the old Gund Arena. I think they just renamed it. So it was actually in that very building, I think, that Lawler and Jake the Snake had that match. I was going to mention Mark Henry's name because Mark Henry actually came out for the save at the end of that match. Henry had just signed a new deal with WWE and was going to wrestle his first match against Lawler the next month, as it turned out, on pay-per-view. So Henry came out at the end. But in that match, part of the story was, of course, Jake the Snake was, he found God, he was a recovering alcoholic, and it was a tasteless move on WWF's part at the time by bringing that into the storyline. And Lawler back in the day did not hold back at all. I mean, if you've seen some of the worst, and by worst I mean some of the most vicious, tasteless Jerry Lawler promos from the WWF days back then, I think I've linked before, I've mentioned the promo on Raw once back during, just before the Attitude days, when Lawler was cutting a promo on Goldust once behind the scenes, and I mean, that was one of the most vicious promos I've ever seen from anybody in the history of Raw. You can find that on YouTube. I mean, that was a vicious promo that Lawler cut on Goldust and his family. And Lawler, you know, he pulled back no punches in this feud either. You know, making fun of Jake the Snake and his problems with alcohol, and, you know, his best friends were Jack Daniels and Jim Beam. And at the end of that match, Lawler poured, I think it was whiskey, down Jake's throat, which in later years in shoot interviews, Jake actually said that it was real whiskey, and it burned his throat. I mean, that's a pretty shitty thing for somebody to do. So anyway, when Jericho mentioned pouring liquor down Punk's throat and giving him a drink, it reminded me of that feud as well. But I mentioned on Facebook, actually, when Raw was over, before I assume people would start posting about how tasteless WWE was to make up such a storyline, because there's probably a lot of people out there who don't realize that this was, first of all, it's a real story. It's a shoot, not a work. And CM Punk himself has brought it up before. When he was back in Ring of Honor, I believe it was, and I linked to that promo he cut on Raven. And back on the indie scene, and you know, Punk cut this promo about how he used to come home and smell the alcohol on his father, and he brought it up, and it was a great promo. So this is a real thing that Punk himself, I'm sure, was fine with and has already cut promos on before, and they're just incorporating it into the Punk-Jericho feud. I don't know if you need to do that. You already had this feud between two guys whose mission at WrestleMania is simply to prove who the best person, who the best wrestler in the world is. Now they've introduced this other element into it, which I'm fine with. I don't know if they had to do that, but, you know, whatever, it is what it is. These two guys are still going to go to WrestleMania. They're going to have a great match. I thought the promo that Jericho cut was great. I did think it was ironic to see Chris Jericho, Mr. Grey Goose himself, who's had his fair share of mugshots taken, tweaking Punk about his alcoholic father and how he's going to turn him into a drunk, too. I just thought the irony there was quite astounding. They also aired a parody commercial here for David Otunga, his law firm. It was a spoof on every single lawyer advertisement you've ever seen in your entire life. It was pretty funny, I will say. They have actually found a way to use David Otunga and make him mildly entertaining. I still don't think he's really all that good, but he is at least mildly entertaining in this particular storyline. He comes out with the bow tie and the thermos. They have actually created a good character for him, because they know he's a shitty wrestler, so they try to use him in these other ways. And I say good for them. I think it's very entertaining. We had Randy Orton and Jack Swagger in a match, and never have you seen a main event level guy in WWE feel like such a mid-carder. Randy Orton does not feel special at all. And I give the guy credit. You know, I don't hear about him complaining, you know, about how, why am I not fighting for the championship in main events and this and that. He's taken a back seat because right now, there's other people. You know, Daniel Bryan is the world champion. He'll defend against Sheamus. I was convinced they were going to turn it into a triple threat match. And then, slowly but surely, I realized, no, Randy Orton really is not going to be in a main event match at WrestleMania. He'll be in a match against Kane. It's a mid-card feud. It's the second year in a row that Randy Orton finds himself essentially in a mid-card singles match at WrestleMania. You know, he fought Punk last year in a pretty good match, beat him. And he'll do the same, I'm sure, with Kane this year. But he came out against Swagger. Nobody really cared. He hit the RKO, pinned him. Kane's pyro went off. That was it. That was literally all there was to it. So this was nothing. This really was nothing. They had the guy from Psych there this week, James Rodet. He was playing the role of a guest ring announcer at one point. He was supposed to guest host Raw with his Psych co-star Dule Hill last year, but he needed an emergency appendectomy, if I remember correctly, and he was not able to appear on that show. He actually did appear on an episode of Tough Enough last year. I do remember that. You can tell which stars are genuine fans of the product, and he actually comes across as being one. So I didn't really mind him too much. He was, you know, inoffensive. His time was limited, and he dropped the Howard Finkel reference. So what more can you really ask for? So this all leads to the main event. We had the Cena rap open the show, and now it was time for the Rock concert. And out comes The Rock. He has his guitar with him. He had a music stand in the ring with the lyrics there and everything else, and I see people complaining, oh my God, Rock needed lyrics to read the music. Just shut the fuck up. If I was going to be singing songs, I would need the music too, okay? So Rock comes out with his guitar. He gets a great response from the crowd. Really over in Cleveland. He did the thing again where he points to his arm. The camera kind of zooms in. He's pointing to these bumps on his arm, which I guess are goosebumps. But to me, hey, he keeps pointing to his arm like that. It's obvious that The Rock has some sort of rash or skin condition for which he should probably see a dermatologist. So he sits down. He sings songs about John Cena, bashing John Cena, making fun of John Cena and his mother, and every verse pretty much ends with Cleveland Rocks, which really wasn't all that different than a decade earlier when Hollywood Rock was on Raw as the bad guy bashing Cleveland. Ironically enough, he did his first or second, I forgot which, rock concert in the city of Cleveland. And at the time, he was a heel, so he was bashing Cleveland and talking about how Cleveland sucks. And now he's a babyface, and he's talking about how Cleveland rocks. didn't see anything wrong with that. Is it cheap heat? Of course it's cheap heat. You know, but The Rock has always cut promos like that. He doesn't have to, I don't think. He's done, you know, he can get by without, you know, the cheap pops, unlike Mick Foley, who seems to need to rely on them every time he comes out there for a Raw show. But it was really no different. Again, you go back to the Hollywood Rock. I loved the Hollywood Rock character back in 2003. I thought it was tremendous. But one of the best promos he ever cut also relied on cheap heat. I didn't see anybody complaining about it then. That was the promo he cut in Toronto, which was one of the all-time great promos that The Rock ever did, in my opinion. When he came out, he was talking about the jabroni-beating, pie-eating, trailblazing, eyebrow-raising, stronger than a bear, faster than a buck, the biggest thing to hit Canada because the Maple Leafs suck. And he got heat, the likes of which I have never seen before. He got those people so angry and so wound up with that one remark, and Lawler was laughing his ass off on commentary, and I just thought it was great. And that was also cheap heat, but again, I didn't hear anybody complaining about it then because he was the bad guy. So I guess just because now he's the babyface, by mentioning Cleveland, somehow he is phoning it in. That's the other thing I wanted to comment on here. I've heard other people say that they didn't like this segment. One commentator in particular berated The Rock for phoning it in, as he claimed. I think these people need to take a Valium and chill the fuck out. How come nobody's criticizing The Undertaker for phoning it in? He's been atrocious on the microphone ever since he came back. Yet I don't hear the same criticism from him from these people. Only seems to be The Rock. Somehow he's phoning it in ever since he came back. Were these people around 10, 12 years ago when The Rock first was in WWE cutting promos like this? Do these people not remember all those other promos The Rock did? These are the exact same promos he was doing 10 years ago. Was he phoning it in then too? I don't remember hearing about too many people bitching about The Rock phoning it in and how much his promos sucked back then. I mean, you either like the guy or you hate him, but everybody who seems to love The Rock, all of a sudden, some of these people, he's phoning it in. I mean, what do you really expect the guy to do? When they announced a week ago that this week Cena was going to rap and Rock was going to have a Rock concert, you were in one of two camps. You either thought, oh my God, they're going to fuck up the promotion of this match. This is a WrestleMania main event. They're going to have these guys go out there and sing. Are they crazy? That was one school of thought. And the other school of thought was, well, this could be pretty cool. I look forward to seeing the Rock concert, which is always entertaining, and John Cena rapping, because it's one of the few things he's actually really good at. And Cena came out, did a fine performance. I thought Cena's rap was great. Rock came out to do his Rock concert, and I thought The Rock had the people in the palm of his hand. Now, did I think that this segment was better than Cena's rap? Let's get to that part. In the end, Cena's rap versus Rock concert, straight up, I have to go with Cena's rap. I was thoroughly entertained by The Rock's performance, but I cannot criticize John Cena for smiling and being all jolly every single week when Rock is usually the serious one, and then not give Cena his props for coming out, cutting an intense, decidedly non-PG promo, and not overstaying his welcome. You know, that was the thing about the Cena thing also. He came out, he did his rap, he dropped the mic, and he left. I don't even know if the whole thing took 10 full minutes. Rock was out there for a hell of a lot longer than John Cena was, and he really didn't have to be. You know, I know why they wanted to drag it out, get a good quarter-hour rating out of it. The Rock was the big draw on the show, so you can't have Rock come out and leave 5 minutes later. I get that. But Cena didn't overstay his welcome, and I think it worked to his advantage. You know, he didn't stick around too long. People didn't start to get bored and tired. He came out all full of piss and vinegar, very serious. He cut a promo on The Rock, and he left. But The Rock, the song kept going on, which was fine in that, again, it was entertaining enough. I thought there were some verses that were actually pretty funny. Some parts were funnier than others. And I was convinced that at some point the crowd maybe was going to start to turn on The Rock, or we were going to hear those Tooth Fairy chants, which Cena had reiterated earlier in the show. It never happened. These people wanted to see The Rock. They were very happy to sit there and listen to him sing and perform, and they gave him a great ovation for it. So it's hard to say that this segment failed or this segment wasn't entertaining. I don't see how you can say that it wasn't entertaining on some level. But it definitely wasn't The Rock's best work. But as far as building up the main event of WrestleMania, I think Cena wins the points this week easily. Rock was funny as hell, but he didn't sell a single extra buy for that pay-per-view. That was the problem I had. If nothing else, the problem I had with this segment is that Rock came out to sing. I don't see how singing a song or three or four, is going to convince people to buy WrestleMania to see you kick John Cena's ass. At least when John Cena came out, he wasn't smiling, he wasn't hokey. It was almost like Bizarro Land, because usually it's The Rock who, you know, even though The Rock does crack jokes and all that stuff, it was The Rock who we saw on television about a week or two ago. Come out, I guess it was the week before, actually. The Rock came out. He was dead serious. He said, listen, you strip away the catchphrases. You strip away the gimmicks. You strip away all of that stuff. I am a 6'4", 270-pound guy that's going to rip out your throat. That was a money line. And then what did he do? He left. Again, he didn't overstay his welcome. So it's kind of weird that this week it was almost the opposite, where Cena came out. He was the serious one. He didn't overstay his welcome. And yet Rock, who was on television last week saying about strip away everything and I'm, you know, this guy that's going to beat you up and rip out your throat, all of a sudden he's kind of reverted back to being the happy-go-lucky Rock cracking gay jokes on John Cena. So if anything, I just think that everything was kind of ass backwards. Maybe this Rock concert, if it was going to happen at all, probably should have happened before that promo we saw last week. That probably should have been what we saw on the go-home show, where Rock comes out and says, listen, all the crap, all the concerts, all the build-up, it's over, okay? Strip it all away. You and me, this Sunday, WrestleMania, you're a dead man. And he walks away. Maybe that's how they should have worked it. I think in that respect, yes, they kind of did things ass backwards here. But if I compare the two head-to-head, I know some people don't like the old John Cena rapper character, and I will admit, you know, here's a grown man coming out wearing, you know, the Mark Price jersey with a backwards hat like he's from the hood and everything. And I could see where people really can't take that seriously. But it's the Cena character that I kind of like the most because of the edge that he had to him. He wasn't any better of a wrestler back then. I mean, obviously, he was probably a worse wrestler back then. But he had a certain attitude that I think is missing. So I actually liked the Cena throwback character. And I thought he did a hell of a job. And what can I say? I give Cena the edge this week. But to say that Rock is phoning it in would be to completely ignore the fact that this was really no different than any other Rock promo or Rock concert that we've ever seen. There were two Rock concerts previous to this. Would these same people have said that he was phoning it in back then as well? I don't think so. And this is a great time now to segue to Hornswoggle. I actually have something to say about Hornswoggle, of all people, this week. Hornswoggle actually posted on Twitter Monday night after the show, ripping The Rock and praising John Cena. You know, I wasn't even going to bring it up, seeing as how I originally figured it might all just be furthering the storyline. It's all a work. But apparently he has since taken those tweets down, which tells me that he was, in fact, expressing his real emotions. So this is what he said. This is what Hornswoggle said. He said, I'm glad The Rock needs to sing karaoke to get his shit in. John Cena will always be a true professional, does not need scripted lines, bullet points, or stupid sexual innuendos like The Rock. This guy must have a little midget brain to go with his midget body. Actually, I'm guessing part of the reason he may dislike The Rock so much is because The Rock has actually used the word midget in his promos, so I really think that perhaps he's legitimately offended by that. But are you for real? Sounds like you've got a really bad short-term memory. To me, that's what it sounds like. I could have sworn that John Cena's entire rap 2 hours earlier was full of sexual innuendo. And I liked it a lot, but to suggest that The Rock is the only person to rely on sexual innuendo, are you kidding me? John Cena threatened to take a dump on The Rock's chest and rub his testicles in the man's face. Last year, when he did that one rap on The Rock, remember the one where he said it would be the last time we'd ever see him rap again? He pulled out a purple pinwheel and told The Rock to blow him. I guess that doesn't qualify as sexual to Hornswoggle. Not only is he vertically challenged, he's apparently mentally challenged as well. This guy is entitled to his opinion, but Jesus Christ, don't go on Twitter and post stupid shit that you're only going to regret later on. It's rather ironic that Hornswoggle would call John Cena a true professional, which he absolutely is, but it's ironic he would do that when he himself behaves the exact opposite way. Let's talk about WrestleMania here. We have some more matches officially announced. I mentioned Randy Orton and Kane is now official. I saw the angle on SmackDown to set the match up, and the only thing I could say is, give me a break. I mean, what a contrived storyline this is. They showed footage of a street fight that Orton and Kane had on SmackDown from last July, And after losing, Kane shakes Orton's hand. So Kane says now that he watches that video every day to remind himself of what he had become. He said that the person who shook Orton's hand was gone, and all that there was now was the monster he should have always been. He said WWE was too big for the both of them, and he needed closure. So explain to me then, why didn't Kane attack Randy Orton when he came back with the mask? Why did he subject us to that horrible feud with John Cena? Why not go after the man that has been haunting him since last summer? This makes absolutely no sense. Kane is a monster. He attacks people for no reason. Why can't that just be the story? Or better yet, you know, here's a storyline I just came up with in 5 seconds. He attacks the so-called pretty boys in WWE. He attacked John Cena. Now he's going to go after Randy Orton. He's jealous, and he's insecure about his own appearance. Hence why he came back shielding his hideous face with a mask, which they still never explained. That storyline I just came up with just now would explain why he's wearing the mask and why he's going after people like Cena and Orton. Voila! I mean, it's still kind of hokey, but it makes a hell of a lot more sense than this. Anyway, I mentioned the 12-man tag earlier. It'll be Team Long against Team Laryngitis. No Battle Royal. Very happy about that. I think we've seen enough Battle Royals for now. It'll be David Otunga captaining a team along with Christian, Mark Henry, and Alberto Del Rio, along with Dolph Ziggler, Jack Swagger. They'll be taking on Santino Marella, who was the captain of his team, along with Kofi Kingston and R-Truth. I think those are the only names officially announced right now. There's been talk that Great Khali might be on the team. Ezekiel Jackson might find his way onto the team, which would make no sense to me, being that Teddy Long used Ezekiel Jackson on Raw in a match against David Otunga a few weeks ago, and he lost. To me, then, that denies you a spot on my team if you've already let me down once before. But there's also rumors that perhaps Brodus Clay will be added. Rey Mysterio's name has been floated as well. Mysterio is still recovering from knee surgery. He may be okay enough come WrestleMania time to be out there on the apron, maybe do a 619. I don't think he'd be able to really do much more than that. But in a 12-man tag, you don't really have to do much. You're not going to have that much time in the ring anyway. So I'm sure Mysterio would love to get a Mania payday. And he's a big star. They'd love to get him on the show. So wouldn't shock me to see Rey Mysterio added to this match. I've heard Sin Cara's name mentioned, which would make no sense to me at all. Because I don't think he's due to be back in action until the summer. You know, he suffered a pretty serious injury, and that was only in November. So I think it's a little too early to be talking about Sin Cara being in this match. Why don't you put Wade Barrett in there while you're at it? I don't think that really makes a lot of sense. It really does suck, though, that Dolph Ziggler is stuck in this match. He's lost in the shuffle in the middle of this 12-man tag team match. To me, Ziggler's work has earned him the right to get a bigger spot on the biggest show of the year. I honestly don't know what you would do with him otherwise. I'd have to sit down and think. I'd have to look at both rosters. I'm sure I could come up with something for the guy. I'm sure they could do the same thing. And at least he's on the show, but I just feel like he should be in a match all by himself. We have the Divas champion Beth Phoenix, who will be teaming with Eve Torres to take on the team of Kelly Kelly and Maria Menounos from the TV show Extra. She is also a contestant on the new season of Dancing with the Stars that I believe kicks off either this week or next. I talked about James Rodé before from Psych and how it always helps to know that somebody is a legit fan of the product, a legit wrestling fan, and this woman is a legit fan. And it doesn't hurt that she happens to be one of the most attractive women that I've ever seen either. I would have rather had Karma challenging Beth for the title. I've said that before, but unfortunately we all know what happened with her situation. That's not WWE's fault. It's not her fault. So if you're not going to be able to do that match, I have no problem with this. At least they're using someone and you know, doing an angle that'll get them some mainstream publicity. I mean, it's not Rodman and Malone on the Tonight Show with Hogan and DDP back in the day, but it's still mainstream publicity nonetheless. And let's be honest, a lot of people are going to treat this women's match as a bathroom break anyway. I may even do that. I'll be in the stadium and I may do that. So whatever. I have no problem with this. A couple of other notes here. Rumor has it that WWE is considering having Jericho versus Punk open the show with Hell in a Cell in the middle and Rock Cena in the main event, of course. I suggested WWE open the show with Punk and Jericho on the sound off a few weeks ago. I think it makes sense, and it gives those two guys the opportunity to have as long of a match as they feel they need to have without having their time sliced in half. I think that would be a crime if you took 15, 20 minutes from these guys and said, listen, you only got 10. I mean, that's completely ridiculous. So I don't know that they will open the show. They are at least thinking about opening the show with Jericho and Punk, and quite frankly, I think they ought to pull the trigger on that. It's also being reported that there are not as many matches slated for WrestleMania this year to allow time for backstage vignettes, including several that will apparently include The Rock. And this concerns me. This concerns me because I don't think Rock needs more than one backstage interview to put over the main event. I think you give John Cena and The Rock two separate interviews leading up to the main event. That's all you need. That's all you need. And that one promo The Rock does, he has to take it seriously and not sing and do comedy. I mean, if they want us to believe that this is truly the biggest match in WrestleMania history, I want to see The Rock talking about whooping John Cena's ass, not singing Elvis or Frank Sinatra. Lastly here, speaking of WrestleMania, word is that a former WWE Intercontinental Champion and mid-card star from the Attitude Era, Matt Bloom, better known as Prince Albert and the A-Train, has signed a deal to return to the company sometime after WrestleMania. Now, it's worth noting here that in light of this news, which broke this morning as I record this show, Matt Bloom has posted on his official Twitter page that the news is false. He says his wife just had a baby, and he's already slated to be on the next New Japan tour, which is true, but that would have been a tour that he was already signed for. So this could just be him, not wanting to... probably not wanting the news to get out, first of all, because they probably wanted it to be a surprise. So it's a little iffy now whether or not this is true. Just because he says it's false on Twitter does not mean that he's telling the truth. Just keep that in mind. But he has been competing full-time in New Japan Pro Wrestling for years now, ever since his departure from WWE. And he has had great success over there as Giant Bernard. That's his name. So if he is on his way back, rumor has it he may possibly be on his way back as a bodyguard of sorts for one John Laurinaitis, which may actually give away the finish of that 12-man tag match at WrestleMania, but I guess we'll see if this news is true. Where there is smoke, there is fire. I've seen it reported by many reputable sites this morning. People apparently within WWE claiming it's true. So for him to go on Twitter and deny it, I would almost expect him to do that. But if he comes in, apparently it'll be sometime in April. So we'll see. I want to talk about Eric Bischoff here. I mentioned earlier on the show that there were two people who said stupid things on Twitter, one of whom was Hornswoggle. I already talked about him. Eric Bischoff is that other person. Eric Bischoff posted the following item on his Facebook and Twitter. He said, "Just had a beer in Nashville. Bartender asked me, I worked for the boss, Jeremy Borash. When I asked what the fuck that was supposed to mean, I was told emphatically that Jeremy had represented himself as an owner of TNA. Jeremy is a low-rent bit player who should be fortunate he has a job." End quote. He posted this at 1 o'clock in the morning. I think this was Monday night into Tuesday morning. And it should be noted that I cannot recall Eric Bischoff using his Twitter or Facebook account to further any TNA storylines in character. You know, he's always discussing his reality TV projects that he works on with the reject kid from the Wonder Years, or he's insulting all of the Mark fans who dare disagree with him, or spends half his time telling us why our president is the second coming of Adolf Hitler. So him suddenly acting like a heel doesn't really wash with me. You know, his Twitter and Facebook are reflective of who he really is. Plain and simple, it was a really fucked up thing for him to say. You're a top executive with TNA, and you go on social media to rip into a guy that works for you, number one, and number two, a guy that really has been a jack of all trades for TNA for many years now, since the company was founded. You know, he's handled ring announcing, he's done backstage announcing, he does a lot of work for the house shows on the road with TNA, he has hosting duties for that Spin Cycle show on their website, and a whole host, I'm sure, of other behind-the-scenes things that we're not even aware of. I have a lot of respect for the work that Jeremy Borash does. And even if you're somebody who doesn't like JB, even if he did misrepresent himself to somebody as an owner of TNA, which is not true, and that really did rub Bischoff the wrong way, which I can understand, you don't go online and say that this guy is low rent and should be lucky to have a job. He should be on his hands and knees thanking me that he still works for TNA. I cannot even imagine Vince McMahon or Triple H as executives in real life doing something like that? I mean, if they thought somebody, you know, was low rent and didn't think much of somebody, you know, they would just bury them on television, 6 feet under, which I could at least have a little bit more respect for. But, I mean, what has Bischoff himself really done for TNA anyway? You know, Bischoff is a fine television performer. Few people can pull off being a smarmy dick the way he can. You know, then again, they say the best characters are nothing more than extensions of one's true self. So that would certainly make a lot of sense. You know, it's a lot easier to be an asshole on TV when you already play one in real life. But beyond implementing some subtle changes in production values and stuff like that, what has Bischoff really done to help TNA? He gets credit for that old reaction show that used to air after Impact, which I actually liked. I thought that was a very cool idea. Well, guess what? Reaction has been dead for a while now. So I ask again, what has he done lately? You can't answer that question because there is no legitimate answer. I cannot think of one thing recently that Eric Bischoff has done to truly help advance TNA. Brutus Magnus went on Twitter after Eric Bischoff's little rant. And Brutus Magnus, a TNA performer, said, quote, "Jeremy Borash is one of the hardest working and loyal people TNA has ever had. Aren't people supposed to be more mature as time goes on, not less?" End quote. I say good for Magnus. I mean, it may not have been a wise move politically for him to make those comments, but he's got my respect for speaking out. You know, and is it possible that Bischoff was just playing, you know, an angle of some kind online? Look, it's wrestling. Anything is possible, okay? Maybe it is the start of some weird angle between Eric Bischoff, an executive, and Jeremy Borash, an announcer. How that helps TNA, I have no idea. And I don't see them doing that storyline. I don't see any hints of it. I don't think they've done anything lately on TV to build heat between the two of them that I'm aware of. I mean, I know I don't see Impact every week, but I am completely unaware of them doing anything like that. So to me, it was Bischoff, you know, maybe in a late night stupor of some kind, going online and making some really stupid remarks that he should not have made. He did say it was the bartender who told him this, so perhaps Bischoff had one too many that night. You knew I'd have something to say about this next item. Vince Russo is now offering wrestling booking seminars, calling it Baby Faces, Blade Jobs, and Booking. I'm going to read to you right now the very quick synopsis of what this booking seminar is all about. This is what it says. It says, during the years of 1995 to 2012, Vince Russo was one of the most controversial figures in the history of sports entertainment. Well, that is true. While serving as the head writer for all three major wrestling companies, WWE, WCW, and TNA. Okay, all true. All true. During that tenure, Russo wrote over 1,000 televised wrestling shows, which achieved some of the highest ratings of all time, while having a hand in helping create some of the biggest stars in the history of the business. From Stone Cold Steve Austin to The Rock, Russo has written for just about anybody who's anybody in the world of sports entertainment. While it is true that Russo, and this is me commenting now, while it is true that Russo has written for Austin and The Rock, it is complete horseshit to lead people to believe that you were responsible in some significant way for Stone Cold becoming who he was and for The Rock becoming who he was. Because as I've said before, there are tons of stories about Russo writing stuff for these guys and them just crumpling it up and throwing it in the trash. So for him to even allude to the fact that, well, I deserve to take credit for their rise and their ascension to any significant degree, give me a break. Anyway, this thing goes on here. Whether it was in front of the camera or behind the scenes, Russo has played an influential part in helping bring the drama of the squared circle to the forefront of American pop culture. Now, in this limited engagement, Russo is going to bring behind the curtain aspects of his job into the spotlight by sharing his craft and experience with wrestling fans around the world. Just some of the topics that Russo will be covering in this no-holds-barred presentation. Where to get your start in wrestling for a professional wrestling organization. Okay. How to use the experience that you've built to get in the door of one of the major companies. Okay. How to create larger-than-life personas and personalities. I think that's debatable. Writing effective dialogue for specific characters. This is something I will give Russo credit for. Supposedly, he is very good at that. writing dialogue, not even for the main event guys necessarily, but for some of the mid-card guys, maybe even some of the lower-card guys who otherwise probably wouldn't even have an opportunity to cut promos. Supposedly, that is one of Russo's strengths, so I'm willing to give him that. How to format a wrestling show, again, something that I'm sure he has plenty of experience doing. He's been doing it now for several years, so fine. If you want to know how a professional wrestling show is traditionally formatted, this is the seminar for you. How to generate new ideas 52 weeks out of the year. I would love to know who's going to be teaching that part of the seminar. Sure as hell won't be Vince Russo, so I'd love to know what guest booker he's bringing in for that part. How to present and sell your ideas to talent. How to create a successful working environment between talent and writer. Dealing with egos, which I'm sure is something he's had to do. This is the best part. This is the best fucking part of this entire thing here. Overcoming writer's block. Overcoming writer's block. Are you kidding me? Vince Russo, the man who, just by looking at his work, has had writer's block now for over 12 years. And he's going to tell you and I how to overcome writer's block. That's unbelievable. Avoiding the pitfalls of politics. Actually, I take it back. I take it back. Overcoming writer's block isn't even the best part. This is the best part. How to generate ratings. How to generate ratings. You can give Vince Russo a lot of credit for having a hand in some of those highly rated Raws from the late 90s. Okay, the last show that Vince Russo wrote for WWF at a time when their ratings were booming was 1999. It was September of 99 when Russo and Ed Ferrara jumped ship to WCW. So from September of 1999 to February, or I guess it was March, right? March of 2012, the end of his tenure with TNA. How many years is that? Over 11 years, by my math. And this guy is going to teach you how to generate ratings. Because, after all, TNA's been doing a hell of a job with their 1.0 to 1.2 every week, seemingly for the past 6 years. But this guy's going to tell you how to generate ratings. This would be the equivalent, like, I work in public relations, okay? This would be the equivalent, let's say that I had 20 years of experience on my resume, which I don't yet, but let's say I had 20 years of PR experience, okay? And in my first 5 years of working in public relations, I had some really bang-up campaigns. I did campaigns for some of the biggest companies in the country that really caught fire and helped generate revenue for these companies, okay? I was in the middle of all of that. I am responsible for that. I take credit for that. That's right there front and center on my resume. For the next 15 years of my career, I had nothing. I worked for one firm, I bounced around to another firm and another one, and I have very little on my resume to reflect my work over the most recent 15 years of my career. So now I'm going to have a seminar. I'm going to host a seminar at a major university or for a PR organization. I'm the guest speaker, and I'm going to tell people how to generate very successful PR campaigns, some of the most successful PR campaigns in the country. Do you think people are not going to look at that and go, wait a minute, why are we bringing this guy in? This guy hasn't had a hit in 15 years. That was 15 years ago. And we're going to bring him in as a guest speaker now to talk about how to generate some of the most successful, compelling PR campaigns in the country? They're going to kick me to the curb. They're going to bring in somebody else who actually knows what the hell they're doing. Now, the difference here is that in pro wrestling, you really don't have too many other writers that have Vince Russo's pedigree that have had this many years in the business, so I understand why he would want to do something like this, but it's just funny to me to see bullet points like how to generate ratings and how to generate fresh ideas, you know, 52 weeks out of the year. This guy is one of the most hated characters in the history of professional wrestling because a lot of people think that a lot of the ideas that he came up with were shit. And when he left WWF and didn't have Vince McMahon to help filter those ideas, he didn't help WCW. He was one of the contributing factors to the demise of WCW. I won't blame him for WCW going out of business because they were already a sinking ship. He certainly didn't help that. He certainly didn't help slow down the demise. He helped speed it up. Then he went to TNA. Then he left. Then he came back. And we see his body of work over time in TNA. So I find it comical that people would pay, and I don't see how much he's charging for the seminar. So I don't know what his fee is going to be. I in some sadistic way, am half inclined to pay for the fee, almost like a mole, and go be part of the seminar, and I can report back on it for the sound off. I'm not going to do that, but in some sick, sadistic way, I am tempted to do so, because this seminar, I mean, if anybody actually pays money for this seminar and you attend, you must send a report into me about this seminar. As much as I hate to pull myself away from the Comedy Hour this week, there are some other news items here to report. It was announced this week that Lionsgate is teaming up with WWE Studios again on a reboot of the Leprechaun movie franchise, which first hit theaters way back in 1993. The horror film is set for a 2013 release, although it currently has no writer, director, or cast attached to it. I'm sorry, but nothing will ever top Leprechaun in the Hood, where the Leprechaun ends up in Compton. Maybe in this movie they'll send Hornswoggle to Compton, wearing all of John Cena's merchandise and pretending to be black. See, now that I would pay to see. Anyway, I was more intrigued by this other little nugget in the press release that they put out, which reads, upcoming films for WWE Studios include No One Lives, starring Luke Evans and WWE personality Brodus Clay, a horror film starring the Funkasaurus going around killing dudes. Sign me up! I'm ready to see that movie tomorrow. I'll be one of these people, like, the Wednesday before the movie comes out, waiting in line outside the movie theater with my tent, like those idiots outside the Apple store waiting for the iPad. That'll be me, waiting for the new Brodus Clay horror movie to come out. Lastly here, for anybody who has WWE Classics on Demand, which, again, I'm very thankful that the service has gotten a stay of execution in light of the fact that the new network isn't going to launch until at least November of this year. They have a new Legends Roundtable, the Celebrities Edition, is currently on 24/7. And if you have the service, I would highly suggest you check it out. It's a great show, as always. But this one, while it is a good show, has a lot of things on it that annoyed me. And after watching this latest roundtable, I have to ask, is Karl Malone holding DDP's family for ransom? First of all, Jim Ross, Diamond Dallas Page, Michael Hayes, and Rowdy Roddy Piper are the panelists on this particular edition. Gene Okerlund, as always, is the moderator. He is the host. And the subject is celebrities and wrestling. So they just randomly talk about some of the celebrities that they worked with, some of the best ones, some of the worst ones, what to look for in using a celebrity, when they should be used, and great examples from wrestling history about when they should not be used and how these celebrities should not be used. That's basically what the subject of this edition is. And on this show, Jim Ross really came off like a prick, I must say. But my God, DDP would just not shut up about Karl Malone. For those of you who don't know who Karl Malone is, he was a very popular basketball player for many years who's now retired in the NBA. And so in the late 90s, he was a big star. And WCW, much as they did with Dennis Rodman, the Worm, another controversial NBA player, they decided to bring Karl Malone in for an angle, and he ended up wrestling a match. So anyway, that's who Karl Malone is. Every time on this show, they would finally move on to a different celebrity. DDP would bring it right back to Karl Malone. By the fifth time, I was just incredulous. I could not believe he would bring up Malone again. And then it hit me. At that moment, why people made fun of this guy constantly backstage during his time with WWE, and why The Undertaker refused to put him over or even make him look good. And you never hear that about Taker doing that with people. He was just insufferable on this show, to the point where even Jim Ross was openly mocking him. You know, they had a thing at the end of the roundtable where Gene Okerlund is wrapping it up, and he says, we're going to go around the horn, gentlemen, and we're going to go to each one of you, and I want you to give me your best celebrity and your worst celebrity. And almost in unison, Piper and everybody at the table, they're kind of laughing, and Gene went to DDP first, I think. And they're all like, well, we all know who DDP is going to pick first. And you could tell Paige was bothered by it, because he knew that everybody was mocking him, and he deserved it. I mean, he really deserved it. But by the way, speaking of Jim Ross here, before I move on with this story, I noticed that Jim Ross was down in Tampa this week visiting FCW for their TV tapings, and they went with the announce team of Jim Ross and William Regal. Can someone explain to me why we're stuck with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler as the A-team every week while Ross and Regal are doing announcing for a local TV show that almost nobody watches? Of course not. You cannot explain something for which there is no logical answer. So, I just thought that was kind of interesting when I read that. I thought to myself, wow, JR and Regal as a team. That would be an announced team I certainly wouldn't mind seeing on my television Monday nights. But back to the other subject. One of our listeners, Tony, actually asked the question, which I used in the latest SC Scoops mailbag, which went up on Thursday, for those of you who may have missed it. Who do I think was actually a bigger celebrity draw? Iron Mike Tyson with Stone Cold in the WWF or Karl Malone with DDP in WCW? And as I said there, I never heard a bad thing about Malone's involvement in wrestling, unlike Rodman. And I know Malone was always a big, big wrestling fan, a WCW NWA fan, I should say, to the point that he would make sure that every show he missed was recorded while he was on the road playing basketball. So that's dedication right there, and I respect that. That being said, Malone did not mean nearly as much to WCW as Tyson did to the WWF. At that time, Tyson was still considered to be the biggest pay-per-view draw in the world. Even though his best days even then were behind him, he was still a big-time draw, the biggest there was. And just looking at the pay-per-view shows that each man appeared on, Tyson's involvement at WrestleMania 14 helped that show pull a 2.3, which was good for 730,000 buys, which was quite a rebound coming off the lowest WrestleMania buy rate that they ever did. Just the year prior, WrestleMania 13 did terrible numbers. Malone's involvement that same year at the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view helped WCW do its second biggest buy rate of all time, behind only that Starrcade pay-per-view where Hogan had his big match with Sting, which was quite the disappointment. Second best of all time, but it was still far short of WrestleMania's numbers. Now keep in mind that we don't know how much of that role, that Dennis Rodman played in that number as well, or whether that number would have been nearly as big with Malone only on the pay-per-view and not Dennis Rodman. Rodman was a much bigger mainstream star than Karl Malone ever was. Probably not a better basketball player, but still a bigger personality than Malone ever was. A lot more controversial. But beyond those two pay-per-views, it did not have the lasting impact that Tyson's involvement had in making the WWF product the it thing again. You know, the rub that Tyson gave Austin was huge. Austin was already on his way up by early 98. But by associating Austin with Mike Tyson, and Tyson, of course, ended up turning on DX and aligning with Austin at WrestleMania. People, I don't think, give enough credit to Tyson's involvement with the company. That's why when they announced that Tyson was going into the Hall of Fame this year, I thought to myself, you know what? If they're going to have a celebrity wing of the Hall of Fame, there are a few other people that I could think of better than Mike Tyson to put in the so-called celebrity wing of the Hall of Fame, because he had a real impact on the product and helped them make a lot of money. That $3 million investment that Vince McMahon made with Mike Tyson, let me tell you something, he made that money back in spades over the course of the next several years. So to compare, you know, Tyson's involvement to Malone's involvement is almost like apples and oranges. I'm even surprised that anybody would bring that up. But in light of watching DDP just constantly bring up Karl Malone's name on this Legends Roundtable, and then I got that question for the mailbag, I thought it was important to address that. But again, if you watch the mailbag, if you watch the Legends Roundtable, it's a good show, but God, DDP does not come off well on that show at all. And the back and forth between DDP and Jim Ross at one point while they're discussing David Arquette winning the WCW title, and again, DDP is defending it, not the move, he also says it was a mockery of pro wrestling and all that, but he defends David Arquette, and Jim Ross, again, he comes off as a bit of a prick on this show, but the interplay between the two of them gets very heated, and for that reason, it's very entertaining, so I would suggest you check that out. It's time for the shout-outs and mailbag portion of the podcast here. If you have any questions and shout-outs and such, you can email me, as always, at thesolemonster@gmail.com. Still the best way to reach me. We'll start out with a couple of shout-outs first. This one comes from Peter. He said that a school friend of his was found dead on Tuesday. He was missing for a couple of weeks. He can't imagine what his family must be going through, and his prayers are with them. He was wondering if I could give some kind of shout-out, extending condolences to them for losing a son and a brother. It would mean a lot to them and everyone who knew Paul Bunbury. So that's a very sad story, and condolences are certainly with them and with Peter. Sucks to lose a friend like that. This one comes from Paul in Dublin, Ireland. He's been a fan of the Sound Off since around episode 50, but is going through a rough time as his dog of over 14 years, Sparky, had to be put down this week. Losing a pet sucks, I know from experience, so really sorry to hear this, and let's cheer things up a little bit, shall we? We have Lee in Manchester, England, who is requesting a shout-out for his 21st birthday, which he celebrated on March 15th. He's flying out to Vegas this weekend to celebrate, so happy birthday, Lee, one of our longtime listeners going back to episodes in the 40s, I believe. And I'm actually going to be in Vegas myself this summer for my best friend's bachelor party, my first time ever in Sin City. I don't know if it's yours, but if it is, enjoy it. Someone I know many of you are familiar with from our Facebook page, Sky Mishra, is celebrating a birthday on March 19th. He was looking for a shout-out on the show. Happy birthday, Sky. I believe it's his 25th, if I'm not mistaken. And I know many of the people on Facebook who know Sky and have engaged in dialogue with him would probably agree that he is one of the most positive, optimistic people that we know. So, in all seriousness, though, happy birthday. And we got one more here to get to. That is from Ravon Adamson, who writes in, I recently started listening to your podcast, and I enjoy listening to you. My cousin Dakari is a listener, and his birthday is on March 20th. Can he get a shout-out? Well, absolutely he can get a shout-out. Happy birthday, Dakari. I always enjoy hearing from new listeners, especially new listeners who bring in other new listeners. That's going to do it for the shout-outs this week. We're going to get to the mailbag questions now. We got a couple of really good ones here to get to. This question comes from Shane in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Dear Solomonster, what do you think of the Rock and Big Show controversy over the 2000 Royal Rumble, where Big Show actually won the match, but Rocky got the win? Why didn't WWF change the record books and put the Big Show as the winner? I mean, I know he beat Rock at No Way Out to make him the number one contender for the championship, but why didn't they change the record books, and what do you think of the decision by WWF not to do the right thing? Obviously, we have a Big Show fan here. And in storyline, as we all know, the referee's decision is final. You cannot go back and overturn a Royal Rumble outcome, and a precedent was set in 1997 when Bret Hart technically won the Rumble, but Austin got dumped out. Referees didn't see it. I think if I remember correctly, the referees outside the ring were preoccupied by some fighting that was going on between Mick Foley and Terry Funk. So Austin crawled back into the ring, threw out Bret, and he was declared the winner of the Royal Rumble. They didn't go back and change the outcome. Austin is still a three-time Rumble winner, but that did set up the fatal four-way match for the title. That's why Austin didn't get his title shot at WrestleMania that year, which I think worked out pretty well for him, all things considered. So it was the same thing in 2000. You know, The Rock was announced the winner. You can't go back and change the winner of the Royal Rumble. That's really it. But I remember that angle, actually. It was actually very funny because Big Show came out on TV. He came out on SmackDown, I think it was. And Triple H and Stephanie, the McMahon-Helmsley regime, was in full force at the time. They were pretty much running the show. And Big Show, who had just cut his hair, I remember this now, Big Show confronted them in a backstage segment, and they were laughing at him because it was the first time that Big Show showed off his new short haircut. This was right after he cut his long hair. And he had a videotape, I think, in his hand. I think it was him, and he brought over the head of security with him at the time. That was that Jim Dotson guy that we used to always see. And he brought Jim Dotson over to as like a character witness, almost, to tell Triple H and Stephanie that The Rock's feet did hit the floor at the Rumble at MSG. I remember Dotson like agreed with Big Show. He looked completely disinterested in the whole thing, and he just walked off. But Big Show had a tape in his hand, and he said, "I have footage! I have footage!" That was the big thing at the time. Big Show had footage that showed Rock's feet hit the floor at the Rumble, and in fact, the footage did show that when both men went over the top rope, Rock's feet hit the floor first. But you can't go back and change the outcome of the Rumble, so there you go. Grant from Kansas City writes in. He's been a fan of the show since episode 110, so here we are 100 episodes later. He gets a question on the air. Two questions, actually. First, how much of Edge and Matt Hardy's love triangle feud was scripted, and how much of it was real? Also, what were your thoughts on it? The feud itself that we saw on television, whatever you saw on TV was worked. Whatever you saw on television was meant to happen. It's not like that first night that Matt Hardy came back out of the crowd, and I think he first attacked them backstage, actually. And then during Edge's match, he came out and attacked Edge. That was all part of the plan. That was not something that was done without WWE knowing about it. And then Matt grabbed the microphone and he was saying, come see me in Ring of Honor, because he was doing a shot in Ring of Honor. That was all part of the plan. But the actual animosity was very real. I mean, obviously what happened is that Edge slept around with Lita, and there was some very real animosity between them, because Edge had been a very good friend of both Matt and Jeff Hardy before that. And look, your friend is not going to take it very lightly when he finds out that you're sleeping with his girlfriend. So I can understand Matt's frustration. What they did was they took a very real situation and they made a storyline out of it, which happens quite often in wrestling. Take real animosity between two people, put them together in an angle, and see what happens. I mean, that's happened numerous times. It's happened with Ric Flair and Eric Bischoff, and I'd say Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, although they were already feuding, but you see many examples of this. But whatever you saw on TV was a work. And as far as the angle itself, I thought WWE really fucked up and dropped the ball on this. I think, if I remember correctly, it goes back to that first night that Matt Hardy was given the microphone to cut his big comeback promo. It might have actually been the week after Matt came out of the crowd to attack Edge. They had Vince McMahon actually introduce Matt Hardy, gave him the microphone. That was Matt's big moment. And it really makes me think, looking back on that moment in 2005, I think it was, how different things might have been had Matt Hardy delivered the best promo of his career. All eyes were on him that night. The spotlight was shining on him. That was his big moment. And I remember his promo was no good. Maybe it was good, but it had to be great. And it wasn't. He did not deliver the best work that he should have. And I think that's really what hurt him. I think that's really what killed him in the eyes of Vince McMahon. And why he wasn't put over strongly at all. I mean, really, if you think about the feud between Edge and Matt, from that first match they had at SummerSlam, which I believe it was at SummerSlam, Matt Hardy was made to look like a complete fool. I mean, Edge beat the crap out of him at SummerSlam. Literally beat the crap out of him. Crap was coming out of his pants. Literally beat the crap out of this poor guy. To the point where the referee had to call the match off. There was a ref stoppage. One of the earliest examples of a ref stoppage that WWE did in trying to re-educate the fans. I mean, now we see ref stoppages, not all the time, but we see them often enough where the fans are kind of accustomed to them. I think that was the first time since this re-education process began many years ago that WWE did this, and I remember the fans were rightfully pissed off at the result. They couldn't believe it. I mean, you had Edge basically just punching Matt Hardy in the head until the referee said, okay, that's it, he can't continue anymore. I think Matt got busted open, so I guess maybe technically it was a blood stoppage, but Matt Hardy looked like a complete tool in that match. And then they had there was a match on Raw that I think might have been I don't know if it was a ladder match. Maybe it was a ladder match with a briefcase above the ring, and the loser of the match was going to be banished from Raw and have to go to SmackDown. And I think Matt Hardy lost that match and was basically banished from the show, and that was the end of the angle. I mean, I can't remember Matt really ever getting any real heat on Edge in that feud, because I think WWE knew that Edge was the future, and this whole Edge-Lita combo was over a hell of a lot more than they probably ever figured it would be. And of course, a couple months later, Edge was the WWE champion before they took the belt away from him, which I think was also a dumb move. So I think they really dropped the ball on this. It should have been more evenly matched up. Matt Hardy could have come out of this a much bigger star, and instead, because he fucked up that promo, and I think also it was a combination of people just not liking the way that Matt Hardy handled things when he first found out about Edge and Lita in real life. Matt didn't necessarily react to that in the most professional of ways, and I think that also hurt him in the long run. But then again, hard to believe, isn't it, that Matt Hardy would have poor judgment in real life? I know, it's hard to believe. Second question here from Grant. What do I think about The Undertaker returning at WrestleMania as the American Badass? Actually, he wants to know if I think The Undertaker is returning as the American Badass at WrestleMania. And to that, I would say I have no idea what would lead you to that conclusion. We just saw the Undertaker on Raw Monday night wearing the hood, doing the dead man gimmick. He would not be doing the dead man gimmick now if he was going to show up at WrestleMania as the American Badass. So, no, he is not going to come back as the American Badass. Rory Bennett writes into the Sound Off. I remember a story about someone in developmental a couple of years ago touring with the main roster in Europe wearing a mask. He claimed to be the next Rey Mysterio and gained a lot of heat backstage for it. I believe it was Alberto Del Rio, but I'm not sure. Am I correct? I'm not 100% sure myself. I know that Del Rio, when he was in Mexico, wore a mask. And when he first came up to developmental, he might have been wearing a mask. And then at that point, perhaps was told that he would not be wearing a mask, which I know with him was a big bone of contention. He did not want to lose the mask. And it's kind of funny looking back on that now, because, of course, I can't think of Del Rio as anything but the character he is now. He's gotten over in large part because of his facial expressions and just the whole character. So the idea of Del Rio not being happy about being told you can't wear a mask is kind of funny to me. I know he also had a lot of heat. He had a big chip on his shoulder. He was already a star in Mexico, so it's not like he's some rookie off the independent scene coming in. It could very well have been Del Rio. It also could have been Sin Cara. Although I don't think Sin Cara spent much, if any, time in developmental, so that might not match up. But it could have been Del Rio. I'm just not 100% sure. Jamie from Niagara Falls writes in, "Great stuff with the podcast, as always. I've been a listener since episode 58. What are one or two matches you would show of Jake the Snake Roberts at a clinic about ring psychology?" And as I mentioned to Jamie here, two matches that come to mind that are not particularly great matches in and of themselves, but do show great psychology on Jake's part. One match is the Tuesday in Texas match that he had with Randy Savage in 1991. The Tuesday in Texas was their first experiment at doing a Tuesday night pay-per-view many years before Taboo Tuesday came along. And it was the first Savage-Jake singles match since their feud started. That was when Savage at the time was retired. He had lost to the Warrior in a career-ending match at WrestleMania 7. I think that was around the time that he and Elizabeth had, in real life, wanted to try to start a family, so he had to get off whatever he was on. Unfortunately, they never did have a kid. But Savage was on commentary for most of the year as an announcer, and Jake had coaxed him out of retirement. This was after Jake had, of course, spoiled the wedding of Savage and Elizabeth and the post-wedding party at Madison Square Garden. That was when the Snake jumped out of one of the gift boxes, and that kind of kick-started the whole feud. Then Savage got bit on the arm by the Snake. So this is their first big match, and the match itself, I have to say, was not even really a great match. I mean, the match went literally 5 minutes, and most of the match was Savage kicking Jake's ass, and then he just out of nowhere went up to the top, hit the flying elbow smash, 1-2-3. It was actually kind of shocking. They expected people 10 days or whatever it was after Survivor Series to plunk down money on a pay-per-view show that really the only two top matches on there were Hogan Undertaker in a rematch and Savage versus Jake. And the Savage Roberts match was over in 5 minutes, so the match itself was not that good. But where the psychology came into play was after the match. So Savage kicks Jake's ass for the entire match. It's personal with him. So even after he beats Jake, it's not enough. He goes outside, grabs the ring bell. All these referees come down to try to stop him. Savage ends up getting the best of Jake. Jake ends up getting the best of Savage, gives him a DDT, lays him out. And Jake is in great pain. That actually is how the match ended. I think he hurt his ribs. He's clutching his ribs. He can barely breathe. But he managed to lay out Macho Man, gives him a second DDT. And at that point, Elizabeth comes running down to the ring because Savage would not let her be at ringside for the match. And this is where things got great. This right here is what makes Jake the Snake one of the greatest heels and villains in the history of pro wrestling. You watch the way he behaves, the things he says, the way he taunts Elizabeth. She's just crying, begging him to stay away from Randy. He gives him another DDT to lay him out and make sure he's absolutely unconscious. And he puts on the black glove that he was wearing at the time whenever he would handle the King Cobra. He brings out the bag, which wasn't even supposed to be at ringside. And as Jake said, as he promised, the Snake was not at ringside, but the Snake was rather under the ring. So the Snake was never really in the bag, as it turned out, but nobody knew that. And he crouches down by Elizabeth, who is huddled over her husband, and he says, you know, "Do you love him? I can't stand that. That makes me sick." And he grabs Elizabeth by the hair. People are just jumping out of their skin at this point. And he smacks Elizabeth across the face. Now, if you really watch it, Jake did this great thing where he barely grazed her face and he stomped on the mat for added effect. But he looked like he smacked her, just decked her right in the face. And you didn't see anything like that in WWF at that time. In 1991, to see Jake the Snake abusing Elizabeth in the ring was, talk about ahead of their time. That's just something you didn't see at that time. And Jack Tunney came down, the president of the WWF, to get Jake out of there, and Jake left. And just the post-match interview backstage where Gene Okerlund is trying to interview Jake, and he's saying how it turned him on. He wants, you know, Savage to bring her back just one more time so he can touch her again. Just really sick, disturbing shit that only would come from the mind of Jake the Snake Roberts. This was just fantastic stuff. And then the second match that I would recommend, which also wasn't a particularly great match. In fact, a lot of people look back on that match as one of the worst in WrestleMania history. I beg to differ. Was the blindfold match at WrestleMania 7 with Jake Roberts and Rick the Model Martel, who had a feud going. And as the storyline went, Martel, who would come out when he was the model with this device, he would spray his own cologne that he called Arrogance. So he sprayed Jake in the eyes once on the Brother Love show with Arrogance and blinded him. And they went full throttle with this thing. Jake, they put special contacts in his eyes, so when Jake opened his eyes, all you saw were the whites of his eyes. As a kid, it freaked me out. Looking back on it now, it's kind of funny. You know, Jeff Hardy comes out wearing weird contacts every week. Rey Mysterio comes out wearing weird contacts. I think Adam Bomb, when he was in WWF, had these yellow contacts, I guess, because he was supposed to be radioactive or something. But all you saw were the whites of Jake's eyes. Like, oh my God, he's blind. You know, where does eyeballs go? So eventually he recovered, and the whole premise of the match was, let's blindfold both guys so that Martel knows what it's like to not have his vision. And Jake, of course, he's Jake the Snake. Snakes have special senses. And let's see what happens when you put these two guys in the ring. And what was great about this match, which I'm sure Jake had a very big hand in putting together, was all of the different moments where Jake would be kind of going towards Martel, and he would point to the crowd, or he would point in the direction of where he thought Martel was and hope that the crowd would help steer him in the right direction and say, no, 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 he's to the left, or no, he's to the right. And I just thought even the psychology in that match, even if the match itself wasn't that good, was actually really well done. So those are two matches that come to mind. I know Jake had a couple of good matches with Dirty White Boy during his time in Smoky Mountain Wrestling. It's hard to believe Dirty White Boy was actually a big star who could actually wrestle, given how he was used when he came over to the WWF as an evil plumber named T.L. Hopper, who didn't seem like he could wrestle at all. But he used to be a pretty good wrestler, and he had a damn good feud with Jake in Smoky Mountain, so he had some good matches there as well. So there is no shortage of good Jake the Snake content. I would suggest you pick up his Pick Your Poison DVD. The documentary is actually really good, if not depressing. And there's some really good matches on there as well. Ravon writes in. He says, he heard last week me talk about the challenge that Eric Bischoff once made to Vince McMahon. How do you think they would have set him up? And do you think Bischoff could have beaten McMahon one-on-one in real life? As I mentioned, Eric Bischoff is a very experienced martial artist of some kind. I don't know I forgot the exact thing he practices in, but he's got some educated feet, as Jim Ross might say. Vince McMahon, as far as I know, is not trained or well-versed in any particular form of martial arts or karate or anything like that. He probably would just go into a fight, you know, throwing some bombs, hoping to beat the hell out of the other person. And now, of course, he's 65, 66 years old. But even at his age then, in 98, Vince probably could have done some damage in a real fight. So who would have won? I have no idea. There's no way to know. As far as how they would have set Vince up, the thing that jumped into my mind is that if Vince actually took Eric up on his challenge and showed up to Slamboree that night at the pay-per-view and gone in there and Bischoff didn't back down, if, let's say, Bischoff found himself in trouble, or even if Bischoff didn't find himself in trouble, if Bischoff wanted to portray the story that there is some sort of interpromotional war going on between WWF and WCW and that Vince McMahon was there as part of the storyline, then all he would have to do is have, you know, some of his NWO clowns come out and, you know, block Vince's way or actually grab hold of Vince McMahon and hold him while Bischoff delivered some kicks to the head or something like that. Whether it was worked or not, just giving the impression that Vince McMahon is working in some capacity with WCW would be a setup. And that's not something Vince McMahon was going to put himself in the position to be. He was not going to be set up by Eric Bischoff. He was not going to give the impression that we're working with these guys. They didn't like each other at the time. And why would Vince go on WCW's own pay-per-view and help them do business? You know, because people would hear about this, and the next night on Nitro, I'm sure Nitro's ratings would be through the roof, and maybe Raw's would be too. But it's not something that would have made any sense. So again, it was a grandstand challenge by Bischoff. that he was a fool, quite frankly, for going on TV and making, and Vince, by not acknowledging it on his TV show, was the smart man. And who would have won a fight between the two of them? I don't know. I think just hand-to-hand combat, I probably would have gone with Vince McMahon. I know Vince hated Bischoff so badly. I think that hatred for Bischoff would have probably superseded any martial arts talents that Bischoff had, and Vince probably would have just cold-cocked him right in the face. Second question here from Ravon. If the Ultimate Warrior and WWE are on good terms, do you think that he will be inducted into the Hall of Fame in the near future? Well, as far as I know, they're not really on good terms. They've been on good terms, they've been on bad terms. Warrior is seemingly on bad terms with everybody. He had some more remarks to make recently about Hulk Hogan in the light of Hogan's sex tape coming out, which was kind of, you know, again, it was really just low class on Warrior's part. But he has showed himself to be that way before. And Vince McMahon and WWE want him in the Hall of Fame. They've reached out to the Warrior. They've made at least one, if not multiple, offers to him before to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And both times he's either rejected them or he has entertained the idea, but they didn't offer him enough money. You know, negotiations fell apart. With Warrior, it's all about money. That's really what it boils down to. And they just couldn't come to an agreement. And so that's why he's not going into the Hall of Fame. It's not a situation like a Bruno Sammartino, where Warrior has, I have my principles to stand on, and I will never accept an invitation into the Hall of Fame. Believe me, if the money and the opportunity were right, Warrior will be in the Hall of Fame. I think one day he will be in the Hall of Fame. But as far as I know right now, I wouldn't exactly say they are on good terms. Jonathan writes in, been a fan of the show since episode 65, was just wondering, with all the talk about WWE films possibly shutting down and their movies not doing well, how do they compare to the first WWE movie they ever did, which was No Holds Barred with Hulk Hogan? It's funny you should mention this, because I recently watched an old primetime wrestling from May of 1989, right before that movie was released. And my God, if you think WWE likes to shove its movies down people's throats now, coming back from every commercial, they were pimping this movie like you wouldn't believe. They literally had No Holds Barred buttons made that the announcers had to wear. Gorilla Monsoon had one on his jacket. Tony Schiavone was a guest on the show. He was wearing one on his jacket. They had posters and banners all over the place. They had this vignette where Demolition, Axe and Smash were even forced to promote this movie. And I can understand why. You know, Vince McMahon financed the entire project himself, and they wanted it to be a success. They wanted it to help launch Hulk Hogan and his movie career, which never happened.
I already heard about one 12-year-old girl who walked in and walked out of the midway. So you have to be very bad, a very bad film, to get a child to walk out of the picture. I mean, to leave the theater. I mean, you know, this is a fun time for them.
What Hulk or his advisors have done is taken a multi-million-dollar image here and really trashed it better than anybody else could do it for them.
How can a movie not succeed when it has such fantastic dialogue as the word dookie after some guy shits himself in Hulk Hogan's presence?
What's that smell?
Or you have the main villain calling everyone who crosses him a jockass.
Jockass!
Not a jackass, mind you.
Jockass!
A jockass.
Jockass!
So I decided, after I first read this question, to do some sound-off research to see, after all the hype and all the promotion, how did No Holds Barred fare in theaters? You know, was the Hulkster as big of a draw on the silver screen as he was in the wrestling ring? So, according to Box Office Mojo, on June 2nd, 1989, which is when No Holds Barred was released, the movie finished number 2 its opening weekend, behind only Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, with a haul of just under $5 million in about 1,300 theaters. It beat See No Evil, Hear No Evil, which was in its fourth week, I think, at that point. That was with Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, by the way, a very funny movie if you've never seen it. And it also beat Field of Dreams, which was in its seventh week out at that point. And it led all new opening films that weekend, including Renegades and Dead Poets Society, which was a Robin Williams movie, which was in limited release at that time. The next week, No Holds Barred dropped to sixth overall, raking in about $4 million. Star Trek V debuted that week, taking the top spot with over $24 million. And Dead Poets Society, which was still in only half the number of theaters that No Holds Barred was playing in, ballooned to over $12 million. And by the end of June, No Holds Barred does not even appear on any lists. Its total domestic gross ended up at around $16 million. Now, on the surface, that actually sounds somewhat impressive. But when you dig deeper, you find out that's not really the case. I searched high and low to find what the budget was for this film to see if they actually made money on it. I came up empty. Apparently, Hulk Hogan wrote in his autobiography that the budget for this movie was about $8 million. Assuming that's true, and to assume that anything Hulk Hogan says, especially in his book, is true would be not a good idea because he's full of shit. But assuming that's true, and remember, Vince McMahon financed the entire thing. When you factor in advertising and distribution fees, he basically lost money on this movie. Maybe he broke even, maybe, but he probably lost money. Either way, there's a reason No Holds Barred has never been released on DVD, which is actually a shame because this film is actually a guilty pleasure of mine. I have it on VHS somewhere, but I'm too lazy to dig it out. I actually like this movie. Stan Hansen is in this movie. What's not to like? Last question here comes from Udit Sharma from Delhi, India. Hey, Salamaster, I'm a big fan of the podcast since episode 156, but I have listened to all of them from episode 85 on. Wanted you to comment on the murder of Bruiser Brody. Who was the wrestler who killed him, and why did he murder him? This is one of those kind of classic, all-time, very sad wrestling stories that you think back to it now. It happened all the way back in 1988. Something like that happening now is almost unfathomable, at least happening the way that this happened. Bruiser Brody was a very popular wrestling personality. He never officially competed in WWE, although most people believe he probably would have ended up there at some point, maybe to feud with Hulk Hogan. Bruiser Brody, if anybody who is familiar with the Berserker character from the WWF in the early 90s, even Mike Knox from several years ago from the new ECW, that's what Bruiser Brody looked like, if you're not familiar with what he looked like. Just a big hoss of a guy with kind of frizzed out shoulder length long hair who would go in there and beat people up. He was not a finesse guy. He was a classic brawler. And he was a very famous star. He's very much like Abdullah the Butcher in that way, in that he competed in a lot of different places, but never really made it to the big time. So, well, he was a big time guy, but he never made it to the, quote, big time here in this country, that being WWF, or I'm pretty sure he wasn't in WCW. And he was a guy who could be very difficult to work with, by all accounts. He called his own shots. He, you know, conducted his own business, and if he felt he wasn't being paid enough or treated fairly, he would pack up and go somewhere else. That's what Bruiser Brody was known for. He was, again, not necessarily the easiest guy in the world to work with. And as the story goes, he was competing in Mexico, preparing for a match in Bayamón, I believe it was. This was on July 16th, 1988. And something happened in the locker room. There was a brouhaha that took place in the showers. Basically, what happened is Invader Number One was the name of the Puerto Rican wrestler. His real name was Jose Gonzalez. Confronted Bruiser Brody in the shower. He actually asked Bruiser to come with him in the shower. They had some business to discuss. And Brody followed him in there, which he shouldn't have done. And people heard a commotion. There was a scuffle that was going on. Some loud groaning noises coming from the showers. Tony Atlas was there. Of course, WWE Hall of Famer Tony Atlas ran over to the shower. He found Bruiser Brody holding his stomach, blood everywhere. He looked up and actually saw Jose Gonzalez standing there with the bloody knife. And obviously, at that point, it was a matter of trying to get Bruiser help. Tony Atlas tried to get him to the paramedics. He was such a big guy, they even had trouble, I think, getting him into the ambulance. And he died. He died from the wounds that he suffered. And Gonzalez, at first, was charged with first-degree murder. And eventually, those charges were reduced. And in 1989, several months later, he was acquitted on all counts, citing self-defense. He claimed he was only trying to defend himself, and Brody was coming after him, was threatening towards him, and he was acquitted of those charges. And I believe even to this day, still competes. You know, he was never punished in any way, shape, or form for the death of Bruiser Brody. And again, Tony Atlas was there. He saw Gonzalez holding the knife in the shower, or as he left the shower, he knew what happened. And there was a lot of controversy with the trial. Tony Atlas was supposed to testify against him, and at the last minute, Tony Atlas didn't show, and he refused to testify against Jose Gonzalez. Now, would his testimony have been enough to put this guy away? Perhaps. He certainly had a strong case for doing so, being that he was a witness to the crime. I don't know that he didn't actually see the crime committed. But as I said, he was there and saw Gonzalez with the knife leaving. And anyway, he didn't testify. I don't think anybody testified against Gonzalez, if I remember correctly, and he was acquitted. And supposedly Carlos Colon, who of course is the father of Carlito and Primo, Carlos Colon has been a staple in the Puerto Rican wrestling scene and runs his own promotion, the World Wrestling Council, now for many, many years. And supposedly he was seen before the incident took place having a conversation with Gonzalez. And not to suggest that he told Gonzalez to do that, but there's certainly speculation that if he didn't, he knew what was about to happen and did nothing about it. There's a lot of people who are not very fond of Carlos Colon, and a lot of that has to do with this Bruiser Brody incident in 1988. So it's a very murky, very depressing story, because here's a guy who was a big-time wrestling personality, well-respected, if nothing else, even though he had some enemies, and could have been a much bigger star as well. Could have been a star here in the States. Who knows what he would have gone on to do. And he was struck down by someone's knife. And that person was never brought to justice, even though pretty much everybody and their mother knows who did it. And the fact that that guy was allowed to continue to roam free, and I believe still does to this day, I believe he's still alive, is literally a crime that has gone unpunished. So that's the story of Bruiser Brody, and that's how we end the mailbag this week. You can send me questions at thesolemonster@gmail.com, thesolemonster, all one word, @gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle on there. I was doing some live blogging during Raw Monday night, as I probably will do again this week. And again, you'll want to follow me on there before I go down to Miami for WrestleMania and all of the related festivities, the Fan Access, Hall of Fame, and everything else. So follow me on Twitter. Friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolemonster. Always good discussion and debate going on there. We live blog with all of you guys every Monday night. We have a very active thread going with literally hundreds of comments as the show goes on. So friend me on there. And you can subscribe to this show in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It's probably the first or only thing that comes up. You subscribe, and whenever a new show goes up, you don't have to download it. It will automatically download for you on your computer, on your mobile device, or what have you. Again, I apologize for those of you who were iTunes subscribers and probably didn't get the show until the middle of the week. This week with episode 209, that yet again was an issue with Podbean, which is the hosting service. I've ranted on Podbean before. They're the fucking dirt worst. First opportunity I get to break free from them, I assure you I will, although I don't see that happening in the near future. But basically, when Podbean goes down, when the hosting goes down, they're the ones pushing the show to iTunes. So it's not my fault when I upload the show, or I try to upload the show, and I'm unable to do so. I have an alternate server that I get the show on when that happens, so people can still download it right away. Unfortunately, the iTunes feed is a little backed up when that happens. It may take a couple of extra days. This is not every week, though, so it's not something you need to worry about if you are an iTunes subscriber. I assure you, you will get the show each and every week, and it still is the easiest way to go about doing that. But I mentioned that just for the people who don't know why that happens or are frustrated when that happens. Believe me, it's not my fault. Nobody is angrier about it than I am, I assure you. And that's the reason why that happens. But still, find the show on iTunes, subscribe, and please be sure to leave us a review. I appreciate the people that have done so very much. And that's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be right back here next weekend, episode 211 of The Sound Off, which could very well be the final Sound Off before I leave for WrestleMania. So if that's the case, we'll have a full rundown of the card and predictions and all of that good stuff on episode 211. That's next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe. A sincere thank you for supporting the show. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
All right, Major Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com.